So, in addition to being a rabbi, one of my favorite subjects is called sociobiology, which is the evolutionary origins of human behavior, which can explain things as noxious as rape or Genghis Khan's battlefield behavior, as positive as the way we care for our children or build homes. In fact, a simple analogy might be, I realized this the other day, that this enormous house in which I live is really just a bird's nest. Just as birds prepare homes for their children to ensure that their offspring and therefore their genetic material are well cared for, so too we build houses. I'm going to share with you a little bit of research on sociobiology. Most of it comes from publicly available sources. So there are a few interlocking fields. Sociobiology is a field that aims to examine and explain social behavior in terms of evolution. It's a cross-disciplinary field that really originated or was solidified with E.O. Wilson's work and contested by Stephen Jay Gould, both in the same department at Harvard for various years. Stephen Jay Gould died after a long battle with mesothelioma, and I think E.O. Wilson is still living or may have died just recently, I don't recall. So a related field, and I think that the boundaries between these two fields are thin, but the one I want to talk about, what I'm really addressing is evolutionary psychology. So the ways in which we behave that have their roots in a hunter-gatherer society on the Serengeti plain. So one of the notations is we care for children and offspring in measure to which they share our genetic code. And a possible evolutionary rationale for racism, for example, might be a mistaken belief that people of another race or color don't share our genetic code. I want to be very clear. I'm making no moral equivalency or excuse for bad behavior. I'm just relating to you the underpinnings of these behaviors in our society and where they may have come from. Someone's dropping me something in chat. And I think what I want to share with you today, Jewishly, that I note in the Parsha, is that Judaism, and in fact most social systems, are at some level an effort to moderate the worst impulses of our evolutionary behavior. And at some level, a failure to moderate those behaviors. I want to talk about that with regard to the Parsha, but of course, you can see evolutionary underpinnings in cases as various as local violence, as the insurrection and riot, the treason at the Capitol about a month ago, in the long history of racism, both here and frankly, even in Africa and Malaysia. Those have evolutionary roots in the ways in which our biology, potentially, and there's certainly debate about this, whether we can carry heritable behavioral traits, but it seems from my observation and reading that we do. We are, I think the Bible would say, ruled by unruly passions. The Parsha this week talks about God speaking of God's self as the impassioned God. Something that Maimonides, in his efforts to deal with the anthropomorphicization of God in Torah, can't seem to square. There is no metaphorical way to describe passion. That God is having passion and emotion is very much a struggle for rationalists like Maimonides, but that is clearly what God says of God's self here and elsewhere. And we see these human beings, these Israelites, these stiff-necked and unruly people of Torah, especially highlighted here in one of the greatest sins and transgressions they commit, as being inherently flawed. And I think this is subtly different from an idea of original sin. Original sin, which doesn't exist in Hebrew vocabulary until about the 16th century, and there only briefly, is an idea that we are inherently sinful. And I think Judaism has a much broader conception that we are like the yin and yang symbol in delicate tension between our yetzer hara, our wicked impulse, our id, and our yetzer tov, our good impulse, which could be the superego, but is also encompasses many other parts of us. And those things are embedded in who we are. That through evolution on the Serengeti plain, or just perhaps the way God made us, so to speak, intelligent design, there is, to quote Talmud and Sanhedrin, there is no misfortune that doesn't have in it something of the sin of the golden calf. Again, not original sin, but the concept that human beings are made to make errors. And some of that is, if not hardwired, then at least a little bit part of our inescapable DNA and destiny. And the effort of religion is to overwhelm and counterbalance some of those wicked impulses. Of course, religion can also do just the opposite. But I think it's so clearly illustrated in the horrible incident of the molten calf this week, where we see the real weakness and rationalization of human nature, the desire to run riot, the chaos that exists in our soul. Moses is gone, and it's not so clear how long they expected him to be gone or whether he's late at all. Some of the Midrashim address this, but they freak out. They completely lose their minds that Moses isn't there, and their first impulse is, and I'm almost quoting here, since we can't find Moses, let's make a god. Right? The things that, it's almost like they don't have object permanence, really. I think someone told me that if you're charged by a moose, you have to get behind a tree because they don't have good object permanence. And it seems like the Israelites in Bible, that's really what they lack continually, is object permanence. You know, there's Parshat Bishalach a few weeks ago where they're rescued at the Reed Sea, and I think it's three verses later, it always strikes me, they complain that they don't have good water. The water is too bitter. They don't like, you know, maybe it's sulfurous, is what I could imagine. This is bad water. You know, you've just been rescued in this miraculous way. Whether you believe that to be literal history or not is not the point, but in the story, they're rescued, and moments later, they can't go back to complaining. So here, Moses has been away for some indeterminate amount of time, and they freak out, and they start offering sacrifices, and they engage in this bacchanal, some sort of festival of eating, drinking, song, and dance, acting basely. And at the very beginning of Jack's reading, it indicates that the real danger in human society, the real danger in what the Israelites did, is disorder. That running riot is the biggest fear. And candidly, that sort of level of chaos and violence, in one of the articles I posted very briefly, it mentions that a lion will often murder cubs who are not whom he did not sire for a variety of evolutionary reasons. And I think that violence exists in us too. We are a violent persons. Our aggression is embedded in the evolutionary imperative to protect ourselves, protect our progeny, and to look out for each other. And we make rationalizations for our bad behavior. And I think that's the real struggle, is the place where sort of the frontal cortex, the non-lizard brain, the ability to think, the ability to philosophize and be psychological, doesn't help us overcome our lizard brain. So this molten calf pot is created, and Aaron says in this most pathetic statement, and I think it justifies why he never rises above the priesthood. He says, I put it in the fire, all these jewels, and look what came out, right? This is verse 32:24. I put the gold in the fire and out popped this calf. I mean, obviously not what happens, right? I think anyone who's done any craft work or handiwork knows you don't just get lucky. And maybe undergirding all of this is the fear of human nature, is the fear of the chaos and the running riot. The Midrash elaborates Aaron's fear, so it creates this scene where he sees his cousin, also I guess Moses' cousin, and Hur is the guy's name. And the people demand the idol, and Hur says, don't do that, that's wrong, that's theologically problematic, you're transgressing. And so they murder him. No, we want the idol, we're gonna kill you. So after Aaron sees it in the Midrash, he kind of stalls for time. So he gives them tasks. He says, you know, bring me all your jewelry, bring me all your gold. And in another Midrash, the women of the Israelites resist that imperative. And he says, and then he delays other matters. He says, okay, I'll get to work on it myself. It's interesting. I'm drawn to mind of an experience when I was in Central Africa, of a father describing female genital mutilation, sometimes called female circumcision, and which surprisingly, is mostly enforced by the women of a community. And the father says to his wife, he says, you know what, let's just wait a little, let's have a doctor do it. So then he has a side conversation with the doctor. He says, you know what, don't do the real thing, just take it, make a nick, make do something symbolic. And so the ways in which, this is also applies to halakha, we channel, I think would be the word, and sublimate the worst of our desires into somewhat socially appropriate, or at least less socially toxic behaviors. And this is, by no small irony, or no small coincidence, I mean, it happens probably every third year. This is the parsha of the molten calf, but it's also the haftarah and the maftir reading of the red heifer. So this unusual sort of brownish red cow is burned, consumed, and its ashes are used, mixed with this fluid, to make the water of lustration or the water of cleansing. And that's how we renew ourselves. That's how we repair from unholiness and tuma, which is often translated as impurity. So again, it pushes me to think that the goal of society, the goal of religious life, to paraphrase Daniel Moynihan, is to gather in our worst impulses and to manage the weaknesses of human beings. And whatever your politics, it seems like in the past years, the worst impulses of humankind have run riot, whether here or Brazil or Poland, or certainly in Russia. Humanity is, as I pointed out, naturally and somewhat evolutionarily problematic. You know, we are little more than animals, and certainly less than angels. And so society puts brakes on those things, and if you take those brakes away from a religious system or a societal group or a community, the worst impulses run riot. And you see this in Papua New Guinea with the continual instances of internecine warfare, inter-clan warfare, and sort of low-level murder that per capita is more violent than World War II. So some of the mitzvot we get, one of the most important mitzvot we get, I think, is Shabbat. Right? The ability to tolerate uncertainty, the ability to learn to be bored, the ability to refresh ourselves and to pull ourselves back from our acquisitive and consuming impulses, to be refreshed, to recognize that we are not masters of each other or the world. God calls it a Shabbat of complete rest and reminds us that we have to take Sabbath even during sowing and harvest. But humankind is so grasping, so acquisitive, so aggressive, so determined to make its mark, that we need to be reminded that even when we are being productive, we must take time to let things be things and to find a new heart and a new spirit, as the Haftarah notices, or as Talmud notices, when God says, Vashavat vayinafash, as we know from Vishamru. They translate it, they make a pun that it's voy nefesh, woe to the spirit that's lost, which is to say that on Shabbat, God gives us an extended or new or extra soul, and at the conclusion at Haftarah, the spirit disappears. So maybe the lesson is that one day out of seven, one seventh, or a little more if you include holidays, of our life, we aspire to be better people. We acknowledge our base instincts. We acknowledge the evolutionary imperatives that cause us to build houses, to fight, to acquire, to grab, to knock down trees, to punish children, to engage in excessive and unethical commerce. And we stop. We stop and find refreshment and awakening to the fact that though we are in many ways animal and human, we can also be one-seventh angel.